there. Welcome back to In the Shadows of Utopia. We have a very special bonus episode today, where we will be speaking to a very special guest, and something that kind of falls out of the chronology of the series. A standalone episode, if you will. I'll be talking to Dr. Tom Chandler of Monash University, where I got my undergrad degree. He's an expert in graphic design, and he's also working on a fascinating project called Visualizing Angkor. As he explains in the interview, basically this project is an attempt to sort of bring together all these kinds of evidence and historical sources, everything that's really available about Angkor, and produce a kind of virtual simulation of the city. You can actually experience some of these simulations firsthand in virtual reality, which is quite amazing. Anyway, I'll let him explain the project more, as we had a really good and interesting conversation about his journey toward the project, the interesting opportunities that this kind of simulation has for historians studying this period. It's a great chat. I'd encourage people to go to www.virtualangkor.com for more information there as well, because it's a great thing that Tom and his team are doing. I've left a link to that website on the podcast website, which you can find in the description. And if you ever feel like sending me an email, you can do so at shadowsofutopiapodcast@gmail.com. So, without further preamble, here is Tom Chandler. I'm sitting here with Tom Chandler, the first guest on In the Shadows of Utopia. And while I've given him a little introduction before the episode started, why don't you just start off, Tom, first of all, how are you today?
I'm great, thanks, Lockie. Yeah, it's good to talk to you.
Brilliant.
Yeah, in my studio office today.
Yeah, it's really nice. I like what you've done with the place.
My name's Tom Chandler. I'm a senior lecturer at Monash University. I'm in the Faculty of IT, and I teach 3D animation and I guess game design, but way back I have a undergraduate in archaeology.
Brilliant. And you're working on simulations of Angkor. I know that's not quite the scope of what you're doing there, but can you briefly tell me what are you doing with the Angkor project?
Okay, yeah, so it's called I call it the Visualizing Angkor project. I guess it's been going for about 10 years. I don't have time to work on it every day. Some of those years we hadn't been able to do much, but in the last 5 years it's kind of taken off again. So what we're doing with this project, I think essentially I'm trying to find out what it is to put all the knowledge and things we know about a civilization into kind of a 3D form, like 3D models, to try and put as much as we can, put it all together inside a computer. So it's like a virtual Angkor. Have we done it all? No, not by any means. We're not even halfway yet. But what it involves, this virtual Angkor project, is involves making a whole lot of models of houses, of trees, of animated characters, of people, of animals, of temples, and kind of positioning them and patterning them over this really large scale map. And a lot of this mapping work has been done by my colleagues like Damien Evans and Christoph Potier. Mm-hmm. And these are large archaeological maps. So we're taking little parts of those maps. Sometimes they're just a few kilometers square, and we're just trying to bring in all the information we can find to make it into a virtual world where there's people walking around and there's rice fields growing, and the temples are there as kind of living focal points of the community around them. So it's trying to reappraise Angkor as a living city, even if only a virtual one, and not a relic or a dead city
mm.
or this enigmatic ruin that is so alluring to all the tourists and people who go there.
Mm.
And it's one of the mysteries about Angkor. But what I'm really interested in is how virtual technologies, 3D technologies, often these are the same thing used for games and high-end 3D animations for movies. We're using that kind of software, but I guess model and visualize and give this kind of form to things that until now was really only at the edge of people's imagination.
Yeah. Well, before we get into the sort of the nitty-gritty, the details of this like really fascinating project, and I've seen some of these simulations firsthand, they're amazing.
Thanks.
Can we talk a little bit about, first of all, your relationship with Cambodia?
Sure.
For most people, Cambodia is sort of, it's like a cheap holiday destination they go to. They spend a few weeks, they have a few beers, they love it. How did your relationship with the history of this country become something that you wanted to sort of professionally pursue? When did you first travel to Cambodia? What made you fall in love with Cambodia?
Sure. I guess, I went there relatively late. I think it was back in 2001. I was 29. And that was the first time I visited there. Before that, I hadn't really had all that much interest in it. And also, it was quite hard to get into. It was quite dangerous to go to.
Of course.
But it wasn't... Before that, it wasn't coming up on my radar with, you know, where a lot of my friends have been or other travelers I met. And nobody had really gone there previously. And I guess I should mention, you know, my dad's a famous historian of Cambodia. And I guess it's kind of common to be... The thing that your parents do is one of the last things you're interested in when you're young. So when I was young and studying archaeology, and I was much more interested in Egypt and the Middle East and South America. I knew about Cambodia, but of course, again, this was, you know, the early 90s, and you couldn't really go there. It just was very hard to get in there. And you get reports on the news every now and again. You'd hear about people getting pulled off trains and shot.
Yeah, the Khmer Rouge.
Yes, kidnapped by the Khmer Rouge. So, it wasn't that high on my list. But okay, so getting back to the first time I went there, I was after university, I went over to the UK and then New York and back to the UK, and I was working as a graphic designer and then later as a kind of a web designer, and then I got into 3D, and that was working in advertising. And, this is the .com boom. This is kind of early days, and there was a lot going on. It was a very busy time, but the work. All of that started to gradually collapse. Mm. And at the same time, I was getting quite sick of the stuff I was doing. So I said, I thought, look, I'm going to travel back to Australia. And then I'll see what I'll do next. I don't know what I'll do next. But I thought, I'll visit Cambodia on the way home. And my dad gave me this list of people to contact there. Mm. Like about 15 or 20 people that he knew. All these phone numbers that I could kind of call up and... So I had some contacts there, and it was kind of a way to engage with the country on a deeper level than most tourists did. But so I went there in 2001. It was still it was very different to how it is today. It was there wasn't many cars around.
Yeah,
a lot of motorbikes, still a lot of Ciclos, still a lot of ox carts. Phnom Penh had no skyscrapers. It was a very different town, very quiet town, and I ended up staying there for 6 or 7 months. So I really just, I got...
In Phnom Penh?
Phnom Penh. I went up to Siem Reap. I went around to Battambang. Yep. A lot of the time in Phnom Penh. And you could kind of rent one of these motorbikes quite cheaply. And just you could just go anywhere. And that's what I was doing, is often just taking this... pretty crummy motorbike that I was always worried it'd break down, but I was traveling in between the towns and around long trips on very dusty roads, driving very slowly because I'm accident prone, but I survived.
I imagine the roads wouldn't have been, they're not that great in some parts of Cambodia. No,
they were terrible then. they were like dunes. Even the main roads, if you were going on a bus or a van, it was just is bone jarring. So I mean, getting around was hard, but the people were wonderful, and I kind of kind of, you know, very soon became fascinated with Angkor and all the, not just the temples around Siem Reap, but some of the ones you can find down in the south in Phnom Da and, you know, out to Battambang and over to Stung Treng and all those places. So I got around it as much as I could. I didn't see everything. I think it was 5 or 6 months I kind of came back to Australia, and I didn't really know what I was doing next. So I thought I'd enroll in a master's. By research, I'll do something to do with animation, maybe 3D animation. It was about a year later when I thought, well, I'm doing something with 3D and animation. I'm really fascinated with ancient cultures and archaeology. Maybe I'll do something kind of 3D visualization for archaeology. And I was kind of working on that for a while. And in the meantime, I was going back to Cambodia and Angkor every year for a few weeks, for a month, as much time as I could get. And I met a lot of Australian archaeologists who were then students, but now a lot of my colleagues who were starting to work on, they were working with out of Sydney University on the Greater Angkor Project.
Is that where you first met Damien Evans?
Yes. Oh, yeah, okay. That's it. It seems like it would have been obvious, but it wasn't obvious to me at the time. But I think it was like a couple of years where it all just clicked and thought, oh, I know what I'll do. It'll be some kind of 3D visualization of Angkor.
So that's how this project sort of started. And
it took me some years to come around to that. I mean, it was right in front of me, but I was pursuing all these different angles. So I enrolled in a PhD at Monash. Yeah, I tried out various ways of what it is to I guess use 3D animation, use 3D models to try and tease out uncertainties in the archaeological record, to try and put information together. And how seeing it in a visual form, with, you know, using many streams of information coming from historical texts and coming from historical accounts and from archaeological accounts, what visualization, trying to articulate what visualization can bring to, I guess, the investigation, the exploration, and the study of Angkor.
That sort of leads me to my next question. What would you say the overall goals of this virtual Angkor project are?
Sure. It's hard to say that there are really defined goals, because it's kind of a project that rolls on and on. And
you've been doing this for
about 10 years. Yes, 10 not every day, of course. But I think I'm if anything, I'm only halfway. I think the overall goal is to really, I guess, see Angkor as a living city, even if it's, and it's a virtual one. And that's a way to really, to see it, to apprehend it. And this is very, I say that there's a lot of archaeological and historical and indeed scientific information that goes into this, but I wouldn't say that it's a thoroughly objective project. Admittedly, it is very subjective. It's very bound up by the technologies of the time. I think, where we can only... So when we say what it is to see the past, we're only seeing a collection of facts that we know put together and packaged in a new way, where it's a new way of looking at what we know about the past.
Yeah.
I wouldn't ever go so far as to say it's virtual time travel, because the past is... As the cliche goes, it's a different country. They do things differently there. And to see Angkor as a living city is really something new. And what is living, in this sense, animation, by definition, to animate means to make alive. So how things are moving, how people are moving, I guess looking at Angkor as a city, as a living city, you're really talking about a very green city as well.
Mm.
And that's another concept that's very interesting. Talking to colleagues, our notions of what a city of the past is. And I guess when we think of, we think of cities in Greece and Rome, Egypt, where we're often thinking of cities that are built from stone, where the gardens and the fields are all outside the walls.
Mm.
So they're stone cities. With a clearly delineated boundary between the green and either the mud brick or the stone walls and the buildings inside. Angkor is very different. It's like a garden city.
Yeah.
And so if you kind of fly over the virtual model, some of it looks like a forest, but if you look closely, it's really all these deliberately planted trees around the houses that are there for shade.
Yeah.
And there's a whole metropolis all linked together through the paths and the roads and the canals, but it's very, very green. Yeah, it's not open and sparse. Yeah.
That sounds very different to the traditional ideas of this city that we've been used to for, the better part of maybe 100 years.
Yeah.
It sort of leads me to my next question. You co-wrote an article a few years ago. I just want to read you a quote and have you sort of react to that.
Sure.
So you say, at Angkor, where the landscape between the temples was previously rendered merely as jungle or white voids on the printed page, we can begin to address archaeological uncertainty with shifting patterns of wooden buildings, trees, settlements, and village shrines. And finally, in this space of interchangeable elements, moving figures, and simulated sound, we can begin to explore the wider potentials of what a historical 3D computer model might offer to scholarship in the digital age. So, what do you think the advantages are of creating these spaces for the modern historian investigating these periods?
Sure. And thanks for rereading my... that sounds very verbose to you. back to me. But I do remember what I was trying to get at there. Some of my colleagues have often, you know, in years past at conferences, one of the terms that's often introduced is to change the what was previously the temple-centric approach of Angkor, which means early scholarship and especially the first French epigraphers and translators and architects and historians and archaeologists who went in there, they're really, really concerned with the temples and what they can glean from the inscriptions on the temples and how they could clear away the vegetation from the temples and whose temples they were and how they, you know, to which god and to which king the temples were dedicated or built by.
This was all part of discovering this lost that's civilization, right.
Yes.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. Yes, and I think, I mean, the fascination, these, you know, the temples are really extremely important for Angkor. You can't deny that, and that's what everyone comes to see. That's really, again, what we call this religious skeleton of the city. So these temples, I guess, if we think of these temples, and especially thinking about village shrines, there's hundreds all over the Angkor Plain. And these have been revealed by extensive mapping by my colleagues like Damien Evans and Christophe Potier. Especially when we think about village shrines or the temples, really what you're looking at is these focal points for a wider community. That's what you're looking at. The remnants of this central, these stone structures that have survived were the focal points for a much larger community that all dwelled in wooden houses, bamboo and thatch constructions. And this is the perishable, green, living city. Angkor was a wooden city with stone temples. So stone temples and brick temples, these were reserved for the gods. You know, as everyone knows, even the palace the king lived in was built of wood. Even though it had stone walls around it, it was a wooden palace. So everything that's wooden at Angkor disappears. And completely disappears. You're very lucky to find just small fragments or beams of wood in some of the temples. They're very, very rare. They do exist, but it's nothing really preserves. None of this wood really preserves in the ground. So, getting back to this, you know, what is it to visually? So, if you have the site of a village shrine, and this might be reduced to a pile of bricks, it might have been totally pulverized by fig trees and long abandoned. You'd imagine the village shrine is kind of like, if we're thinking of, you know, comparing it with medieval Europe, these village shrines are like the little village chapels in Europe.
As opposed to like a cathedral.
Exactly. Or the, you know, a quite substantial church in a large town. So yeah, that's a good comparison with the temples. So around there, if you've got the remains of a village shrine, you've perhaps some idea of perhaps the size of the community that was around it. How many, you know, roughly how many people it took to sustain this village shrine. that was the focal point of the of that community's religious activities for their festivals. And, you know, this village shrine is linked to another village shrine not far away, and there's a neighborhood of them, and they're linked to a larger temple. And that becomes kind of this anchor point, the little stone remains where you can start to reimagine the communities around them.
So it's not just this. When you go to Angkor today, you've got your Angkor Wat, and then a few kilometers of motorcycle away, you've got a Ta Prom or
Angkor
Thom. So you're giving us everything in between these spaces, which
That's right.
A long time did no one know what were there, or
hardly anyone knew about them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly some of the archaeologists knew about them, but they didn't have comprehensive maps.
Yep.
They couldn't relate all these small shrines together until fairly recently. So this is some of the work that the University of Sydney and the Greater Angkor Project kind of revealed gradually, as this huge metropolis. The size of Angkor was incredible.
It's a mega city.
Yeah,
in modern terms.
It's often said that it's about the size of modern Los Angeles.
Yeah,
but it was at its height the biggest city in the world, but it was not the densest. There were other cities in China with many more people in them.
Okay.
They were just much more compact.
I see.
So, but it certainly was the biggest in kind of aerial extent at the time. So you've got, when we talk about all these village shrines, they're part of that city.
Yeah.
It's pushing the analogy too far to say that they were suburbs, but what people, when they go to Angkor, when they're visiting Angkor, they're really looking at the urban core.
Mm.
Yeah, so the CBD.
Yeah.
You know, for want of a better comparison. But
and there's skyscrapers that still remain.
That's it. And then there's all the suburbs all around that, and other temples even further out. So, and getting back to addressing that quote that you read to me, I think, so, you know, if you can take this ruin of a village shrine, and if you roughly know the date of it, you could start to look at how you could swap in models, because there's so much uncertainty when you only have a pile of bricks. Exactly what did the shrine look like? Well, it could look like a number of designs, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been well established there's kind of there's an art historical progression and kind of relationship between certain styles of architecture and art at Angkor. This is this is well known. So early on we were experimenting with, if we have a site of a village shrine where there's just a ruin there, well, it could have been a number of different designs. And we had this kind of system where you could swap in one of 20 or 30 different variations to take that place.
Yeah.
And then where did the
on
trees...
On the fly as well, just... You don't
that's
have
it.
To you know, redo your thesis there. You can just...
That's it. And well, that's one of the things about this virtual world. It's very dynamic because there's so much uncertainty. So if you have it looking just a particular way, then there's so much of it that is speculative or wrong.
Mm.
But you can swap in different models and rearrange models to try and tease out different hypotheses. And, and really to sit down with scholars and kind of go through things. What if it was like this? What if it was like that?
Mm.
Perhaps it was like this.
For instance, you've shown me Angkor Wat in different color schemes.
That's
different
right.
Materials.
Yep.
Different.
Yep.
Yeah. It's fascinating.
And that latest model we made of Angkor Wat over the last, I guess, 4 years here at Monash was what that model would do is it would kind of ran through a series of different variations, because all the art historians and many of the archaeologists and some of the historians we talked to, there was a lot of disagreement about exactly what colours it could have been, or whether it was coloured at all. There was a lot of people said they just didn't know.
Mm.
And there was, you know, particularly for things like all the vegetation, when we mentioned the green city, you don't know exactly where the trees were. It's very hard to determine. You can know from archaeological pollen cores, which have been extracted, what kind of trees were in the area from the pollen that is left over in some of the moats or the ponds that they extract. But you can only really, you can kind of start to put this together by looking at how the present day Khmer settlement patterns and settlement patterns, even especially the photography from the 19th century,
mm-hmm.
from colonial photography. You can look at what kind of trees Cambodians had around their houses,
yeah,
and whether these trees were native to Southeast Asia. Some of them are brought in after the Spanish and Portuguese brought all these fruits over from South America. Now, they wouldn't have been at Angkor, so you have to rule those out, and you have to look at what species were there, how close were they to the houses, and what did the houses look like? Well, luckily, I guess from the historical photography, from the especially the colonial period, the houses seemed of the regular people, the common people, the peasants, they seemed to be pretty similar to the ones Xiao De Guan was describing.
We'll get to Xiao De Guan in a minute as well. But I guess you're filling in the gaps in between the temples of Angkor. But I should say that you can, using virtual reality technology, we can actually step into these gaps as well. We can see firsthand that the gaps in between these temples. I should say that due to a couple of technical mishaps and some dead batteries, last time we spoke, you weren't able to give me the full VR treatment of the virtual Angkor project. But in the meantime, I've actually purchased my own VR headset. I've been able to spend some time with the technology. Mm. And I've been blown away sort of to the extent that your mind allows itself to be immersed in these environments. In one game, I was thrown off of a building and I did experience a certain degree of vertigo and sort of shock at being, you know, falling to my death. So while I've been enjoying these games and videos, I've also been able to finally check out some of the immersive 360-degree videos from the Virtual Angkor project that I wasn't able to see last time. They're amazing. I've really enjoyed them. I've stood on the causeway looking at Angkor Wat as people, busy little animated people, went about their jobs. I've sat in a marketplace. I've been to the rice paddies. I've sat on a canoe going down one of the canals. For me, this is sort of a dream come true. I've often loved the idea of sitting in a bubble and sort of traveling through the past and looking at people do these things. So thank you for that. Now, there was a moment I looked out at this rice paddy. It was sunny. There were clouds in the distance, a rumble of thunder. It was really quite beautiful. But what that did, every time I've visited Angkor, I've been going there since 2011. I've tried to build on my understanding of this city. I've tried to imagine what it was like as I walked around this skeleton we're talking about now. I've tried to fill in the gaps in my imagination. But it was not until last night that I sat in my living room with my VR headset on that I've actually been able to fully realize that goal. So, like we've sort of been talking about you filling in the body around this skeleton. Mm. And this is something I think that is missing from a lot of people's experience of traveling in this beautiful archaeological site today. And I think a big part of that, and you sort of mentioned it, is the details going into this simulation.
Mm.
I would love for you to talk to me about this attention to detail. For instance, the sound of a woman sweeping her house, the detail of the various fruits sitting in this market. How have you and your team managed to do this?
So that's, I guess, the answer to that is just time. Oh, we have time on our side. All this detail just takes time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to 3D model all these things, especially if they're animated. But there is one, there's one saving grace here in 3D modeling. So, for instance, a sugar palm tree, which is emblematic of Cambodia today as it was in the past. That takes a couple of days to model in 3D accurately.
Yep.
And this is using photographs of sugar palm trees and making sure that the 3D model's not too clumsy in terms of how it's constructed, so that it's not so that you can make a lot of them and it doesn't take too much space. In other words, it's an efficient model. It's modeled efficiently. So it takes, as I said, a day or two to get it right. And that might seem like a long time to make just one tree, but the saving grace is once you've made it, you then have untold thousands of them.
Yeah.
If you need to. And the same goes with the modeling an elephant, which is, again, another emblematic animal of Angkor. You only need to look at the bas-reliefs and the sculptures, to know how important they were to Angkorian society. That modeling and animating an elephant, detailing all the wrinkles in its skin, how it moves its ears, the pace of its walk as it plods down the road, getting these things kind of right, that can take weeks.
So you've built all the assets in it? There's not some stock?
No, yeah, there's unfortunately not. The no, there's cast nowhere
from Age of Empires.
No, there's nowhere we can really steal this stuff from.
Okay.
And yeah, it's all our own models. Now, again, with the elephant, it takes ages, but once you have one done, you have an elephant army if you need one. And one day we might try that, but at least you have as many elephants as you need. So the same thing goes with the people. Modeling a person and getting them to walk is difficult, and then we're trying to animate some of the gestures, the body language, some of the ways that people react to each other, and how they look distinctly Khmer. You know, these small animations, these small movements, they're really important, because how two Khmer people at Angkor might have conversed with each other when they were sitting down would be quite different from, say, how two people in Song Dynasty China might.
Mm.
And just the way that they'd move their hands, some of the things they do. This is, this is part of these subtleties and details that we haven't really got to yet. But this is something I'm really interested in.
Mm.
Is, perhaps we, looking at the bas reliefs, you have clues about certain gestures that people made, not just how they stood, but how they sat, and how they reacted in groups. All these kinds of things, and some of these things you could glean from present day Cambodia. Some of them they're pretty mysterious. Yes, and again, the bas reliefs. Unfortunately, a lot of the bas reliefs they do focus on the royal court, and they focus on very important people. There's some hints of the everyday life of just the regular people of Angkor at the Bayon, but it's not a lot to go on. That historical photography is also really useful here. I guess things like photographs taken by the Dutch in Bali around 1900, these can be very useful as kind of giving some broad hints about how people would have congregated in markets. It's not exactly like Angkor, but given their dress and attire and the Hindu religion as a kind of a Hindu kingdom of Southeast Asia, these give us some more hints about how Angkor might have looked, or at least a kind of a reasonable proxy to help us kind of generalize some things.
Yeah. It's amazing how close to the source you've gone to create this world. I didn't realize it was all built by you and your team and all modeled.
It is. And thankfully I've got a very good team of, and without them, I don't think much of this would be done at all.
Mm.
They help with, creating some of the characters, modeling some of the environments, putting the structure of everything into virtual reality.
And you've been to Cambodia to draw from these things firsthand as well, haven't you?
Yes, sure. I should mention also, you mentioned the sounds earlier. We record sounds in Cambodia whenever we can get them.
Mm-hmm.
My early days when I was there, you just be recording frogs, you'd be recording people talking, you'd be recording the sound of the wind through the kind of pandanus hedges along the rice fields, the recording the sounds of birds, or recording anything you can grab from the environment. It's really hard now, to get these sounds with the rapid development of Cambodia, especially around Angkor. There's always planes in the sky.
Yeah.
So it's you kind of have to go further out into the country to capture this stuff. So that's all really important. So again, all the detailing, it's also very iterative. Mm-hmm. a lot of the things we made years ago we'll go back and fix, or we'll be interviewing one of my colleagues or one of an expert in a certain area. might bring up something we haven't thought of before, or point out something that we might have a little bit wrong. So it's slowly
get in there and change it.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. So there's a lot that's being slowly updated and changed.
Well, it is amazing to be, like I said, be in there and see and hear these things.
Sure.
Like with the VR headsets, it's quite amazing.
But Lockie, if I could ask you a question, it was quite clear to you that it was all virtual though, right? I mean, the characters did look like computer characters, and it, even though we try and make the models quite faithfully, you're not at all fooled that it's a real world.
No.
Yeah.
No, you're not fooled into thinking you're actually there.
It's not photorealistic.
But
like
it
some
is
of the,
filling in these gaps of imagination that I brought up earlier, where if you're walking around Angkor today, for me at least, it's a struggle to use my mind's eye to see these things. And if anything, this is that the way forward, I think, for doing that for a lot of people, even though it is not a photorealistic simulation, it still does inform your imagination of the
past.
That's
right. And I mean, that's, it's interesting. It's good that you said that, because, I mean, some people have asked me, well, you know, can you do things even more realistically? Mm. I mean, so this is a real push in all kinds of simulated, virtual worlds.
Well, that's been, it seems, the trajectory of video games for the last
20
years. It's just been more polygons.
That's it, yes. And I mean, eventually some of them might be indistinguishable from reality, from video reality. I'd really like to give it a certain aesthetic that as soon as people are in there, they know it's a kind of, it's a computer mediated world.
Mm.
It looks like an engaging computer game.
Yeah,
the characters are almost real, and the landscapes are almost real, but they have a consistent aesthetic, so that everything looks like it kind of belongs in the same virtual space.
Yeah, you feel like you're in a video game.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And one of the things I'd like to argue here is that I think this technology is absolutely ideal for imagining the past, because it's not real, and it's patently not real, but it's engrossing and convincing. You can suspend your disbelief, like being inside a video game.
Yeah.
You know that the game's not real. So this is really important. That and I think for your generation, for my generation, particularly for all my students, there's a very developed understanding about these virtual worlds, as they're essentially simulations. Everyone's aware of this.
Yeah.
So it becomes this ideal tool to try and swap in ideas and test things. And
rather than contending that this is
yes,
this is what it looked like.
Yes.
You're not saying that. You're saying that given the information that we have, this is the picture that we can make.
Yes, and
sort of animating history.
Yes, it could
be writing history.
It could be like this. So this is plausible given the information we have. This is an important distinction to make. So I think where some of these visualizations of the past draw criticism is when they try to be almost more real than the real thing.
Yeah.
And or if they just present perhaps, especially true if it's just one image. See, our world is a moving, dynamic world. But if it's just a highly detailed, a single image, often it's a lot of people argue that this is kind of dangerous, because it's almost announcing, proclaiming that this is how it was.
Mm.
Yeah, you're making a statement on things. So it's important to have a lot of wriggle room when you're trying to visualize a past about which there are a lot of uncertainties.
Yeah. Well, speaking of uncertainties and the sources of history that you've used to create these simulations, we mentioned him before, but one of the most important people we have to inform our picture of Angkor is Zhou Daguan.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, depending on when I release this episode, either before or after the Angkor Part 2, our listeners may not be aware of who this guy was and why he is so important to the historical study of this period. So let's assume they don't. Tom, can you tell us who Zhao was and why this guy is so crucial to your work?
Sure. Zhou Daguan, or Zhao Daguan, he was a Chinese diplomat who visited Angkor in 1296 until 1297.
So what's Angkor sort of looking like in that period?
Well, it's not it's not obviously in decline, okay. although Zhou Duguan mentions there are constant wars with the Siamese that he hears about, and that much of the countryside is in ruin. But when Zhou Duguan went there, it was very much a thriving metropolis. He evokes the phrase that he hears many Chinese sailors have used, that they call Cambodia rich and noble, and that is, it seems to be extremely rich, that there's gold everywhere. There's Zhao Duguan, he talks a lot about the officials he sees, their adornments, the goods that are at Angkor. He's very impressed with the size and scale of the temples. Quite likely, he was staying not far from the royal palace inside Angkor Thom, and probably because he was a Chinese envoy or diplomat, he was staying with a Chinese community there.
Okay,
you know, and possibly hosted by Khmer household. But so, what is most valuable about his account is the only eyewitness account of Angkor.
Zhou stayed in Angkor for a year?
About a year.
And then he wrote a book about his stay.
That's right. He stayed there for about a year, and he wrote the book, I think, much later. Or people think, you know, after he returned back to China, he wrote his memoirs of what he saw there. And it's many people believe that the chapters we have, some of which are very brief, when we talk about a chapter of his memoir, it might just be a paragraph. It might only be 100 words. Some are longer. Some are a couple of pages, 3-4 pages. But many of the chapters are probably missing entirely. They just weren't transcribed regularly. They were there when he wrote them, but they've been lost. Maybe some of them exist somewhere in some archive, which would be fascinating if we could dig some of these up.
Yeah.
So, but the value of his observations is that, for me in particular, they're very visual. Zhao describes colors especially.
Yeah.
He describes very small details of, you know, even these palanquins that people were carried around in, almost like they're almost like litters, or like a hammock kind of suspended from a pole carried by two people with someone important sitting in the hammock. He describes all the goods in the market. He describes the relationships between the people there. He had a very good, he saw the palace, he saw the king out in procession. He gives us, you know, to work with as an animator, some of these things are extremely valuable. He describes the people as well, you know, what they look like. A lot of the value of Zhao Duguan's eyewitness account is that the inscriptions you get at Angkor, of which there are many, these are written in stone and often they're installed at the temples. They're pretty dry. Some of them could be construed as propaganda. I mean, they paint everything in the most positive light possible for the person who commissioned the writing. Some are useful in terms of what they're describing in the goods that were donated to the temple and how things were kind of managed. But
sort of like someone's tax return or
that,
something
that's
like
right.
That.
So yes.
You can get a lot of information from a tax return. But
yes.
If you wanted to know how that person felt,
yeah,
what they were wearing.
Like a tax return or an obituary almost.
Yeah.
So, but they're not eyewitness accounts. They don't really go into the detail of how people live their lives. And certainly they're not, there's a large segment of the population is kind of written out, or these are really inscriptions commissioned by the elite and often about the elite. And they'll list people on, you know, villages are mentioned, but often in kind of lists of people attached to the temple. And so there was a whole lot of writing at Angkor. There was undoubtedly, you know, libraries in the temple where texts were kept on palm leaf scrolls. Zhao Duguan describes these. He describes people writing on deer skin. He describes them writing on again palm leaf with a stylus. There's a whole lot of writing going on there, but that's all lost to us.
Yeah, like the wooden houses. All these
that's it. It's all perished, and it wasn't. Yeah. It, it, if it was copied down, it wasn't recopied.
Yeah.
And it's gone. So what remains is the writing in stone, which we're fortunate to have. And then there's Zhao Daguan's account.
Well, one of the most prominent scholars of Cambodian history, actually your father, who you mentioned before, he wrote something along the lines that, you know, Zhao Daguan's account, it's provided historians with a kind of home video of his travels in Angkor. There are some quite lurid details that you might expect someone's weird uncle to include when they've come back from Spain or something like that. It's a home video as opposed to a feature-length documentary, and that's what your dad kind of he wishes that we had that feature-length documentary. It's kind of like trying to base your ideas of a country on someone's Instagram account of that country. So what would you say are some of the pitfalls of using this account, that like having this be such an important part of the scholarship on Angkor? What are some of the problems that you've encountered using the customs of Cambodia, which is that book he wrote?
Yes, I get. Well, I mean, there's you have to be aware of, I guess, who Zhao is and who he's writing for, and he sounds like one of those British Victorian travellers, traveling through the colonies and kind of often disdainful of the natives he sees there and their practices, and, you know, in equal measures, you know, impressed by some things and kind of disgusted or appalled by others. Mm. So, and where, you know, Zhao might be getting some of his information, he might have been getting it second hand. So,
because there's a lot of people traveling from China to Cambodia, trading and things like that. Would he be getting sort of pub stories from some of these guys?
Possibly while he was there, he could be. But, I mean, not all of it, but you can get hints of that. Mm. That, you know, he's often honest. He says, I've heard such and such, but I do not know the truth of these, or I couldn't follow this up in more detail. Okay. So he's often reporting what he remembers. Yeah, getting back to what it is to extend his home video account into a documentary. We've found one thing I've realized with the venture of visualizing things is we can take just a couple of sentences from Zhao Daguan's account, and that might take us months to deal with in an animation.
Yeah.
So it's almost it's almost the other way around. We've got this quite brief account, which again has some chapters only have just a paragraph in them, but we can take one of these sentences and we have to choose our excerpts carefully, and we try to animate a scene that goes with that excerpt so it can appear on the bottom of the screen like subtitles, and we just find so many things just arise out of that. So and we have a little bit of freedom, as you know, to, you know, where we would place that scene that Zhao Daguan describes. So one thing we found was really difficult was trying to create a market that Zhao Daguan describes. He describes a market at Angkor. Well, where exactly was the market? But he's sure. He describes how they lay out their goods on the ground. But, you know, when you get into visualization, you have to think, well, was there anything else behind him? Was there stalls? Who was at the market? Was it... And Zhao Daguan does describe... So he gives you enough to kind of get you going. But then you find once you start making it, there's so much more that you have to ask about. And, for instance, he describes the palace. And the palace, the ruins of the palace are still there. A lot of people go visit it. And he gives a pretty good description of, you know, the colour of the tiles, the roof, on the main building and some of the subsidiary building. He talks about the king's audience hall, all of these things. And then you go to the palace, you walk around it, and you start to get a sense, this could be done. And then you sit down with a team of modelers to start modeling it, and very soon you realize that you're at an impasse. You don't know exactly which way a building's facing. You don't even know if a building was there. You don't. There's all these things that pop up. So you can remedy this by kind of pulling the virtual camera further away and showing less of the palace and suggesting more, or hiding it behind trees. And these are devices you have to use. Getting back to Zhao Daguan's account, I mean, depending on what little excerpts you pick, small sentences become just whole universes, visual models. I mean, yeah.
It's really amazing. I'm becoming increasingly aware of how generous you've been with your time already. Tom, it's been a real pleasure. I can't thank you enough. Is there any kind of websites or social media that you would direct people to if they wanted to know more about the virtual and core project?
The websites can be a bit convoluted, but there's the... I mean, the URLs can be a bit convoluted, but there's a Google Arts and Culture page, which will be up soon. And there's also a website I developed with my colleagues here in the History Department at Monash, which is called virtualencore.com. And
I'll leave a link to that website on my website as well, because crib off some of the information you've put there, because it's truly fascinating and informative.
And a lot of the stuff's not... I mean, a lot of the stuff still is on the university computers and hard drives as we're still testing it and refining it, so... That'll come online gradually.
Brilliant. Well, I'm sure people will be aware of it because it is amazing work.
Thanks, Lockie.
Yeah, all right. Great to talk to you. Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Really, thank you very much.
Thanks.